From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the Starr Report with Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. Toobin has an insider's perspective on the work of a special prosecutor. He was an assistant counsel to Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh during the Iran-Contra investigation. The Jewish New Year begins Sunday at sundown. We'll talk about Jewish cooking in America with Joan Nathan, who has a new PBS series and book on the subject. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The stock market is proving today it can take away what it gives. Shortly before the hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 217 points, the result of a huge sell-off that began immediately after the opening bell rang in New York this morning. NPR's business correspondent Jack Spear joins us live. Jack, what's happening with the market today?
Well, Korva, it's sort of like a second-day take for the stock market. Yesterday, the market closed higher, and that followed Chairman Greenspan's appearance before the House Banking Committee. Now, today, apparently, the market's decided it didn't like the comments made or not made at that hearing at all yesterday. European markets were sharply down. Japan lost almost 2.5% of its value, and it all has to do with the fact that no interest rate now appears to be forthcoming.
Do you think we'll ever see an interest rate cut?
I think eventually we may see one. I think the markets now feel that we may, however, not see that cut coming up at the Fed's September 29th Open Market Committee meeting. And that, of course, is what many of the world markets have been banking on. It's looking less likely, and that's what the market is reacting to today, along with the fact that third quarter earnings are coming in and they're not good.
So can we expect more wild market gyrations? Are things going to go up and down a lot until the Fed meets on the 29th?
I think we can expect to see at least some of the volatility we've been seeing in the near term. And as we mentioned, those third quarter earnings are starting to come out. They're not looking good. And even more upsetting to a lot of people, especially individual investors, is they'll begin getting some of their mutual fund and 401k statements. And those are not going to be pretty either.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Jack. NPR's business correspondent, Jack Spear. Lawmakers could decide today if President Clinton's videotaped testimony in the Monica Lewinsky case should be publicized. Republicans want to release the tape. Democrats want to block it. The videotape is exceedingly sexually explicit. Cable channels CNN, Fox, and MSNBC say they plan to show the entire videotape unedited as soon as they get it. CNN says it will air verbal advisories that the testimony may not be suitable for children. Rescue teams are continuing to search for four missing Marines whose helicopter crashed into the Pacific Ocean last night. The Marines were aboard a Huey helicopter practicing takeoffs and landings when it went down off the USS Rushmore. Sergeant Janice Hagar is the base spokeswoman.
The search area is a 15-mile radius around the crash site, and the search and rescue efforts are going to continue throughout the day. And they have been nonstop. It went on all throughout the night.
The Marines say there is no word on what caused the helicopter to crash into the ocean. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average before the hour down 217 points at 7,872. The Nasdaq down 42 at 1674. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Florida Governor Lawton Chiles says the state will get $1.7 billion more from tobacco companies as part of a renegotiated settlement with Florida's tobacco lawsuit. Tobacco companies will also agree to new restrictions on Florida advertising. The state's lawsuit settlement would now be worth $13 billion. The settlement ended Florida's lawsuit against the tobacco industry over the treatment of six smokers. The 57-year-old flagship airline of the Philippines has announced it will shut down next week after a decade of economic difficulties and a crippling summer strike. Craig Katz reports from Manila.
A 22-day pilot strike in June brought Philippine Airlines to the brink of disaster, but in the end it was the ground crew of the airline that may ground it for good. A week ago, the employees' union accepted management's offer of 20% employee ownership in exchange for 10 years without new collective bargaining negotiations. But Wednesday, the employees' group reversed itself, forcing management's hand. Today's closure announcement would leave the Philippines without a true international carrier and with only small, mostly financially troubled domestic airlines. For that reason, there will surely be a lot of pressure on the government to intervene, but it's not clear if they will. There seems to be no inclination to bail out the airline's $2.1 billion debt. One possible maneuver would be to call for rank-and-file referendum on management's final offer. For NPR News, I'm Craig Katz in Manila.
General Motors says it's phasing out two of its longtime models, the Buick Riviera and the Oldsmobile 88. GM says production of these vehicles will be stopped in November due to slumping sales. 1,400 workers will be laid off. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeffrey Toobin, is writing a book about the Starr investigation and the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. He's covering the story in his positions as staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. Toobin is a lawyer who established his journalistic reputation with his intelligent reporting on the O.J. Simpson trial. Toobin has some firsthand experience in a special prosecutor's office. He was an assistant counsel to Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh during the Iran-Contra investigation. I spoke with Toobin early this morning, before the House Judiciary Committee began its meeting, about whether to release the videotape of the president's grand jury testimony responding to questions about the exact nature of his physical contact with Lewinsky. I asked Jeffrey Toobin if there's any precedent for releasing videotape of testimony before a grand jury.
There actually is, to a certain extent. Every time there's a trial, a criminal trial, the defendant is entitled to see the grand jury testimony of any witnesses that the government calls in its case. So defendants often see the grand jury testimony of witnesses against them in criminal cases. So one of the things that I think there's been a little misinformation about is that it's somehow completely unprecedented for anyone ever to see grand jury testimony. It is virtually without precedent for any grand jury testimony to be videotaped. So the format of the disclosure is certainly rare or certainly unprecedented in my experience, but the mere fact that grand jury material is disclosed is not all that out of the ordinary.
But you're talking about disclosing it to other participants in the trial as opposed to disclosing it to the public. Is there a difference?
Well, I think there, you know, in big cases, that material often filters out to the public. You know, in most criminal cases, the public doesn't care about the grand jury testimony. Certainly, there's never been this kind of celebrated disclosure of grand jury testimony, but the notion that grand jury testimony always is inviolate is just not correct.
Some people are saying that Kenneth Starr is taking advantage of the fact that President Clinton chose to testify through video, and it's taking unfair, it's like punishing him for having used that form.
I think this is a fascinating issue, and I think both sides bear some fault here. Certainly, I think the Starr team has exploited some of the vulnerabilities that the president has had because he is the president. But it's important to remember that it was the president's team that insisted on this videotaped deposition and refused to walk in to the grand jury. You know, I think this was a tremendous miscalculation, and there were some members of the league, and this is not just hindsight, there are some members of the legal team who were thinking this at the time, that, hey, once you go before video cameras, there's going to be a permanent record of this. And through whatever legal mechanism, they were worried that it was going to come out at some point. They were saying, look, you go into the grand jury room. Sure, there is an element of humiliation of actually walking in and being the first president to do that. But the one thing you can be sure of in a grand jury room is that there's no permanent videotape record. And I think that's going to be prove to be a historic miscalculation on the part of Clinton's lawyers.
I think the House Judiciary Committee is thinking that the point of releasing the video is the public's need to know, the public's right to know. What is the role of public opinion in impeachment hearings or in even the decision of whether to hold impeachment hearings?
Impeachment is more of a political process than it is a legal process, and it doesn't operate according to legal rules of evidence. It is a product only of Congress, and I think both sort of in the Constitution and in fact, Congress especially the House of Representatives, is designed to respond, at least in part, to the will of the people. And they are not going to impeach someone if their constituents dramatically do not want them to do that. So the public doesn't have an official part in the impeachment process. But I don't think, you know, we should pretend that they are not, that they don't have a role. And I think keeping the public involved is a legitimate concern of the Judiciary Committee and everyone else in Congress.
How do you think the release of this video might change the story?
Boy, I've been wrong so often on that. I think it's hard to imagine how it could do anything good for the president. Certainly there will be just the mere fact of the president discussing these extremely intimate and embarrassing subjects is going to be unpleasant. You know, the famous Clinton temper is apparently going to be on display as well. And I think perhaps worst of all is some of the legalistic distinctions that his lawyers have been so greatly taken to task for, you know, the most famous being that the president didn't believe that oral sex was sex. Instead of being in the lawyers' mouths, these statements are going to be in the president's mouths. And if people and if people think that, you know, he's weaseling or at worst lying about this, I think it's really bad.
My guest is ABC News legal analyst and staff writer for The New Yorker, Jeffrey Toobin. What happened to the grand jury? What has the grand jury's actual role been in the release of the materials?
Well, as a former prosecutor, I have to say I have a lot of skepticism for the grand jury as an institution. They are essentially rubber stamps for what the prosecutors want to do. I mean, they are 23 people, of whom 16 you hope show up at every session, and they don't even have to be the same 16 people. But basically, in addition to just other than lobbying in a few questions, this grand jury had even less to do than most grand juries, because most grand juries, at least at the end of the day, they have to vote indictments. They didn't have to vote anything for this report. This was completely the product of the star prosecutors. They sit there and they listen to testimony, but in fact, they have nothing to do with the direction or results of this or any other investigation.
So what's the point of having the grand jury?
Well, this is, in legal circles, that issue has been debated for a long time. And the fact is, the Constitution, I think it's either the Fifth or the Sixth Amendment, speaks of the need for grand juries, that you can't be indicted for a felony without a grand jury. I think, you know, there's not much chance of a constitutional amendment changing that, but they are, to a great extent, a fiction. You know, they're the famous line from former Chief Judge Saul Wachler of the New York Court of Appeals is that any prosecutor worth his salt could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. And I think that is demonstrably true. And this myth that you have to persuade the grand jurors of something is just that. It's the prosecutors who run the show. And that's true in this and every other investigation.
And what happens to them now?
Well, they're actually still in session. And one of the the mysteries here is what Starr will continue to do with them. There are reports that he is still investigating matters related to the Kathleen Willey incident. He has a grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington, that he's still supervising. He still has jurisdiction over Filegate, the Travelgate, Whitewater, and he has filed no reports regarding those matters, and presumably he will file reports with the three-judge court that supervises his work or potentially return indictments about them.
Jeffrey Toobin, you were an assistant to Lawrence Walsh during part of the period that he was special prosecutor investigating the Iran-Contra affair. How would you compare the charges of Iran-Contra to the charges against President Clinton?
I think if you ask most Americans, they have a much clearer idea of what oral sex is than what the Boland Amendment is.
It's, I think, a fair statement.
I think that's the root of some of the differences between the two matters. I think it's easy to say that, you know, Iran-Contra was, you know, so much more serious and this is trivial, yet this is getting more attention. I mean, I think it is actually more complicated than that. Iran-Contra was a very complex and serious matter regarding whether the White House violated congressional restrictions on aid to the Contras in Nicaragua, and then lying about it later. I mean, I think there are real issues about whether that all of that, however serious it might have been, whether it was appropriately a criminal matter. And Walsh and I later had some disagreements about that. I think the irony here about the Lewinsky matter is that I don't think there's any doubt that everyone agrees that perjury and obstruction of justice are crimes. There's just the dispute about whether the underlying matter is serious enough to merit all the attention we've given it. So I don't think they are perfect counterpoints to each other. They actually have a good deal in common.
Lawrence Walsh was quoted in The New Yorker as saying that during the Iran-Contra period, that he and his assistants knew of, quote, awkward personal relationships, unquote, in the Iran-Contra inquiry, but they wouldn't question anyone about it. Do you have any memories of how that was treated and why?
Gosh, that's interesting. I wish I'd known. I don't remember any awkward personal relationships. I think we had a much more deferential attitude towards the office, if not the occupant, of the President of the United States in the Iran-Contra matter. We did written interrogatories to President Reagan. Then Vice President Bush gave an interview, but I think once Bush became president, they also dealt with him more in writing. It's ironic. I simply don't even remember. Perhaps there were other people who were privy to these discussions. They certainly didn't get very far about even the discussion of subpoenaing the President of the United States. So I think, you know, we were cognizant of the, you know, the significance of the president in the constitutional scheme, and I think we treated him and the office itself with a lot more respect than Starr has treated the Clinton presidency.
Do you think that Starr has expanded the definition of special prosecutor significantly since the days you worked with Lawrence Walsh?
Oh, absolutely. I think if there is any sure thing that comes out of the Lewinsky matter and the Starr investigation as a whole, is that there is a close to a national consensus that the independent counsel law is a monstrosity that is completely out of control and will be, when it expires next year, 1999, it will be either sharply limited or done away with altogether.
And what do you think the after effect of that will be?
I think actually it will be a good thing. We'll go back to the situation that there was at the time that Archibald Cox was appointed in the early 70s, which was in the events of really serious conflicts of interest about the president himself, the attorney general will be able to appoint a special prosecutor under his or her supervision who will be able to investigate with great political independence. Now, the argument against that is, well, what about the Saturday Night Massacre? Isn't that why we have an independent counsel law? And my answer to that is, what about the Saturday Night Massacre? The political cost that the president paid for that was so high that I think no president will fire a special prosecutor in the future without taking grave political consequences. And the cure here is so much worse than the disease. These endless debates that we have about whether independent counsel should be appointed and whether the triggering mechanism of the statute is too high or too low, I think personally they ought to do away with the whole thing and let the Justice Department prosecute people if people need to be prosecuted, and stop these incredibly expensive and really disruptive and unfair prosecutions.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is staff writer for The New Yorker and ABC News legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. The charges against the president now are perjury, obstruction of justice, witness tampering, and abuse of office. What's your sense of the charges that he's most vulnerable on?
I think, based on reading the Starr report, he's most vulnerable on perjury and obstruction of justice with his secretary, Betty Curry. I think the abuse of office charges are really, there's something deeply wrong with the nature of those charges against him. I mean, basically, the core of those charges is that by citing executive privilege, that is in and of itself an abuse of power. And I guess I am enough of a lawyer to think that the mere fact that you're using available defenses, which executive privilege was, and which the courts ruled did apply in the cases, in the circumstances that the president asserted it, the mere fact of citing those, I think it's really repellent to think that just because, you know, you don't like the underlying conduct, that the citing of the privileges is an abuse of power, and I think those charges will fall away rather quickly. But I think the Starr report, though we've only heard one side of the story now, makes a very powerful case that the president lied in his Paula Jones deposition and in the grand jury. And I think it makes a least a plausible case that he tried to get Betty Curry to lie in the immediate aftermath of his his deposition in the Paula Jones case.
What he was lying about was sex in what we understand, according to the testimony, was a consensual relationship. Are there degrees of lying in situations like this? If you lie about a consensual sexual relationship, is that the same as lying about behavior during a war or lying about a friend who committed a murder that you witnessed?
You're asking a question that is really at the heart of this whole inquiry, and I think, you know, people bring very different political views to that question, and I think this debate over whether all lies are created equal is one that is certainly, you know, going to be at the forefront as Congress debates this issue. I hate to weasel out of this, but you know, I'm troubled by it. I really haven't decided in my own mind how I feel about this. If he had just lied in the Paula Jones deposition, and then when confronted about it in the grand jury, had said, you know, I panicked, I was wrong, I'm sorry, I you know, it's obvious I had sexual relations with this woman, it's obvious I didn't behave properly, you know, I apologize. That would be, I think, one circumstance. However, that's not what he did. He went into his grand jury testimony, which, it's worth remembering, is still less than a month ago, and stuck with this story, which, you know, is troubling to me if, in fact, it's proved that that story is false.
The president has been arguing that his relationship with Monica Lewinsky wasn't technically sex because she performed oral sex on him and he didn't touch her erogenous zones.
And we know, after all, he was on the phone, so I guess that's part of his defense.
but Monica Lewinsky testified that he did touch her breasts and genitals. What is the law for determining who's right in a situation when it's two people alone in a room, there are no other witnesses, and they are contradicting each other?
The law is really pretty simple. It's a matter of whom the jury believes. You know, the standard in a criminal case is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and there is no law that says sort of one witness isn't good enough. It's if the jury believes one person rather than the other, that's the law. But I think this whole issue of the sort of look ma no hands defense is underlines the difference between the political process of impeachment and the legal process of perjury. If this were a criminal case and this was a count of perjury, in this recount of perjury, there would undoubtedly be a great deal of testimony about what Bill Clinton was doing with his hands during these oral sex encounters, and that would be something the jury would confront. Congress has a very different calculation. The Republicans in Congress are very worried about making this investigation all about sex. And they are very weary of the entire country gathered around their televisions, looking at the testimony in their hearing room, and it's Monica Lewinsky testifying about what Bill Clinton was doing with his hands. They don't want that. And the Democrats, Clinton's defenders, know that. So they have to walk very gingerly about this. And they there is a lot of behind the scenes worrying about, especially on the Republican side, about how they can make the case against Clinton on perjury without getting into all these salacious details that they think will reflect as badly on Congress as it will on the participants in these now famous sexual encounters.
The definition that everybody has been reading and debating about what sex is that a fairly standard legal definition of sex? Is there a standard legal definition of sex?
There are many poetic definitions, but not many legal. It comes from, it's not a standard definition of sex. That definition of sex comes from a fairly recent statute involving sexual abuse. And a federal statute, and it was just sort of taken whole from there. You know, one of the interesting sort of lawyering questions that comes out of this is, you know, the Jones lawyers were trying to be so cute and so official, and they gave him this, you know, fancy definition of sex, and in an effort, it seems, to pin him down. In fact, all they did was confuse the situation. If they had just simply asked him, did you have oral sex with Monica Lewinsky, a lot of these problems could have been avoided, and they would have given him far fewer outs than he had through this silly definition. I think, you know, it is, there is no standard legal definition of sex, but it is one that that appears in the federal law but fairly recently, and it's not used all that extensively.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. Our interview was recorded early this morning. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, schmaltz and pickled herring, Jewish cooking in America with Joan Nathan. First, more of our conversation with Jeffrey Toobin about the Star Report.
Catch me a killer, you load 16 tons of hard salami. Corned beef, rolled beef, and hot pastrami. I huck a rind, everything gets a western. I owe my nishumi to the delicatessen. I
was born one morning and I gave a geschrei. My mishpuche was happy, it was a holiday.
Good job, Jeff.
I wanted my bottle, I felt real chipper. I didn't get nothing cause it was Yom Kippur. 16 tons all kinds smoked fishes, latkes, blintzes, and hasty knishes. Holladi, nehme schnell to the promised land. A fire auf dem Boss soll werden verbrennt.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded early this morning about the Starr Report with Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. He's also a former prosecutor. Jeffrey, you're covering the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky story now and the possibility of impeachment hearings, and you also covered the O.J. Simpson trial and wrote a very popular book about that. And a couple of questions I want to ask you about those two cases. DNA has played a part in each of those two cases. In the O.J. Simpson trial, the DNA evidence was highly contested. In the Bill Clinton story, I mean, no one seems to have contested the DNA evidence on that Blue Gap dress. So what does that say to you about the future of DNA evidence?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, given the surreal nature of sort of modern journalism and law, I mean, the connection between the two is actually somewhat more direct. You know, Lucien Goldberg, the famous literary agent who persuaded her friend Linda Tripp to tape Monica Lewinsky, you know, she's also Mark Furman's literary agent, Mark Furman, the disgraced LAPD officer who was so involved in the Simpson case. And when the first reports of the DNA stained dress came out, Lucien Goldberg asked her client, Mark Furman, you know, what's the deal with this DNA? Is it really reliable? The fact is, there is a difference between semen DNA and blood DNA. Blood DNA, if you recall the defense in the O.J. Simpson case, it wasn't actually that the DNA, the tests were unreliable. It's that the blood had been planted there. It's that Simpson's blood had been sort of put somewhere. You can't really plant someone's semen without getting it in the first place. And I think there were really no reliability issues here. And also Clinton admitted an improper relationship with Lewinsky, so he's not. They were in no position to contest that it was his semen. However, it's an interesting question. We'll never know. But if these DNA tests had not been available, would Clinton even have made that much of an admission? You know, hard to know.
There was a whole media infrastructure that was put into place during the O.J. Simpson trial. And I'm wondering if you think that part of that infrastructure is now covering the Clinton Lewinsky story.
Well, I guess present company, I'm a girder in that in infrastructure.
All right.
You know, I think there is a tremendous interest in and sophistication about legal affairs on the part of the American people. I mean, you know, there was a time when if you said the words grand jury or subpoena or deposition, that they required some explanation. You know, I think there is not total knowledge about these matters, but the drama of investigations and trials and legal maneuverings is something that, thanks to people like Scott Turow and John Grisham, but also to you know, Marcia Clark and Johnny Cochran, is something that seems to be, and you know, from my selfish perspective, one can only hope, is a permanent part of the news infrastructure. And I think this the traveling band of legal analysts will move from case to case, you know, from now to eternity.
Marcia Clark and Johnny Cochran had their own shows. I'm not sure if they still do or not. But have you seen them be experts weighing in on the Clinton Lewinsky story?
Oh, absolutely. Marcia Clark is a substitute on the Geraldo Rivera, substitute host on the Geraldo Rivera show, and Johnny Cochran has a show on Court TV. And, you know, one of the great complaints about the legal analysts, and certainly my own complaint is I try not to do this myself, but you know, there's this practice of acting like all these lawyers are the greatest lawyers in the world, and they're always critiquing the performance of the people who happen to be in the spotlight at the moment. You know, if you look back on the Simpson case, you know, you have to wonder what gives them the right to be experts about much of anything. But no, the Simpson Alumni Association is well represented in this one.
You had to deal with the rumor mill in the O.J. Simpson story, and now you're dealing with it, I'm sure, in the Clinton Lewinsky story. Are there a lot of rumors that are being put out to the press now?
There is. This has been an extremely difficult story to cover. It's actually somewhat easier now than it was in this period between January and August, because almost everything we knew between January and August about the investigation came in the form of leaks, often from Starr's office, but not exclusively from Starr's office. A lot of defense lawyers knew information from their clients testifying in the grand jury, and information, you know, came out through that route as well. But it was really hard, I think, to maintain some sort of journalistic discipline in terms of reporting the progress of an investigation when, you know, it was illegal for the Star people to disclose anything. And, you know, we in the press have a tremendous sort of bias here because, you know, on the one hand, you know, we are the people who are begging the Star office for these leaks. And that's, you know, what our editors and our producers expect of us, and that's something that we're supposed to do. Yet in our general role as kind of policemen of the facts, you know, the fact that the Star office was leaking was relevant in determining the credibility and the responsibility of that office. And I think the Star office, you know, got away with a lot because we were so dependent on them and very reluctant to blow the whistle on misbehavior.
Can I ask how you dealt with those leaks?
Well, by not getting a lot of them, I think. I mean, I you know, the work that I did, I for the New Yorker tended to be a little bit off the main stories of what was being disclosed at any given moment. But I think certainly in my work for ABC, I would often analyze the latest leaks and what that meant for the case, and I think by doing that, you know, I was a party to these leaks as well, and I think that's one of the issues that as we get some distance from this story, we're going to have to, you know, search our souls about.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. Salon published the story that Henry Hyde, the head of the Judiciary Committee, had an adulterous affair 30 years ago. My understanding is that story was shopped to several newspapers, and they turned it down. And I'm wondering if you are aware of this going on now, if there are other stories being shopped around of other sexual indiscretions on the part of people in Congress.
I am aware from firsthand knowledge that there are stories in this genre being shopped around, and it's a real struggle. And I think, again, this is one of the most difficult areas to be dealt with, because, you know, I think, you know, all of us in the press are aware that, you know, politicians, like anyone else, deserve some measure of privacy, and it is just repellent to us that people's personal lives will be, you know, the subject of everyday attention. However, we are also aware that if, you know, Congressman X calls for the president's impeachment on the grounds that he's immoral and that he committed adultery, and that congressman himself had committed adultery, I do think that's fair game. Now, I think the Hyde story is you know, repellent in every way, because Hyde had never been one who said anything about the, you know, the president being impeached for adultery. I think it was a completely unfair and inappropriate story to run. But with some other people, I might be more interested.
Everyone is covering this story, and I'm wondering what it's been like for you to find your place in this kind of mass journalism.
It's funny that you mention that. It's something I struggle with a lot. I mean, especially at The New Yorker, where, you know, we pride ourselves on, you know, providing information or analysis that you can't get anywhere else, yet staying, you know, fairly close to the news and being sort of on top of these very covered stories. I mean, I think what I try to do is concentrate on taking a step back and not look at, you know, what day-to-day developments necessarily happened, but sort of why, you know, why, say, the Republicans are so afraid of seeming sex-obsessed. I mean, what are the roots of that, and how did that happen, and what's the context for that? And trying to pick out corners of the story that are ripe for exploration that other people won't, that other people don't have the resources or the time or the sort of background to do. But I ain't going to kid you, it's hard. I mean, you know, I look at the New York Times and I see that they have 20, 30 reporters on this story. And, you know, it's an intimidating prospect. They're all very good.
Well, where do you go? I mean, at the O.J. Simpson trial, you show up in court. There's a place you're supposed to be every day where the story unfolds. But the story is unfolding in many places, and there isn't. You know, where do you go to find out what your story today is?
It's interesting. I mean, this is again something that I have noticed about this story, that it has a particular kind of formlessness. Iran-Contra had a similar problem. Ultimately, you know, you did have Central America, but the Washington part of the story didn't have the scenes that you want as a journalist. I mean, today, obviously, the House Judiciary Committee will be a place to be, although it's an executive session. I mean, being on Capitol Hill as, you know, the 535, you know, congressmen and senators deal with this and talk about it constantly, and all their aides talk about it constantly. That's a place where you'll get a lot of opinions, if not necessarily always a great deal of insight. You know, the White House is another place. I mean, you can't wander around the White House the way you can Congress, and the Star Office is certainly off limits to reporters. But this story doesn't have a center, and it is sometimes frustrating that you don't have a place to go. But I do think increasingly Capitol Hill is going to be the headquarters of this story, and that's where all the drama is going to take place.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Let me let you get back to your work of the day. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, as always.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. Our interview was recorded early this morning. The Jewish High Holy Days begin Sunday at sundown, and for many Jews, it's a time for preparing and eating traditional foods. My guest, Joan Nathan, is the host of a 26-part PBS series on Jewish cooking in America, and she's the author of the companion book. It wasn't Grandma's gefilte fish that got her thinking about Jewish food. She got interested in the 1970s when she was working for Teddy Kollek, the mayor of Jerusalem. Her PBS series covers such subjects as the Borscht Belt, the Sabbath dinner, brisket, the Jewish pot roast, the nosh, Jewish fast food, and the history of chopped liver. In one edition, an elderly Eastern European immigrant demonstrates her recipe for gefilte fish.
Well, this woman, her name is Doris Selganik. She's 92 years old. I should say 92 years young. She lives in Cleveland, Ohio. And she came over to this country in 1911. She remembers everything. And it was actually, we filmed that one in my kitchen in Washington. And everybody, the people showed up because it was, you know, my kitchen was being filmed. And it was hysterical. I was just cracking up. This woman, who had never been on television before, could have been Mel Brooks' older sister. She was so wonderful. But what was really wonderful about her is that she told the story of the immigration. It could have been, it doesn't necessarily have to be a Jewish immigration, but it's the immigration of the Eastern European to the United States. And the importance of something like gefilte fish in her life.
What was the importance of gefilte fish in her life?
Well, for her, I think it brings everybody around her. Everybody expects her to make gefilte fish. She makes a big deal about it each year, how much it costs. She cuts it up. She uses an 85-year-old hand chopper. And she's chopping it in this wooden bowl. And she doesn't believe in food processors. She tastes the fish and... I think that what this fish recalls for her or represents for her, as it does for other people that have been in this series, is her life. And it's the link between generations. The fish, as she makes the fish, she thinks about Russia or the Ukraine where she was born. She thinks about her mother and her father, who, of course, are long gone. She thinks about her children. She thinks about what she's doing for her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren. She's thinking about the tradition of the Jews, the Jewish holidays. All these things go in her mind as she makes this one dish. So that, to me, this woman, especially in this series, represents traditions, not just what we put on the plate.
What is gefilte fish?
Okay, well, gefilte fish traditionally meant, gefilte means filled fish. And what it was chopped fish that was put back in the skin of a fish, and then it was simmered. I'm sure she does it for 3 hours. I do it for 20 minutes. And then it's served cold with a gel. And I suspect the reason that she really cooks it for 3 hours is that she wants to reduce the stock to a gel. Of course, you can reduce it without having the fish cooking for 3 hours, but this is the traditional way she did it. And then you serve it cold. Traditionally, gefilte fish was something that was used for Jewish holidays, but also the Sabbath. And the reason that you ate gefilte fish cold was that you couldn't cook on the Sabbath. And also, one rabbi told me that you're not supposed to pick, you're not supposed to really work at eating. And by chopping the fish and putting it back in the skin, or as we do, more of a lazy American way, is we make it in patties, you wouldn't have to pick at anything. You could just eat it.
Did you like gefilte fish as a kid?
Well, as a kid, I must tell you that we always had canned gefilte fish, and I thought it was awful. And in my house, we had it before the Passover Seder. That was really the only time that I think that we ever had it. My mother-in-law makes gefilte fish from scratch, and it's wonderful, but I never liked it as a kid, and it's taken me until I had hers to realize that it can be good. And of course, what makes it even better is good horseradish.
My mother recently told me that when she was young, and her mother, my grandmother, used to make gefilte fish from scratch, that it would just terrorize my mother, because sometimes, like, the fish broth would boil over on the stove and it would, you know, smell up the house as it was cooking, and just that smell of fish drove her crazy.
Well, it still drives me crazy. I don't really like that smell, particularly when I do it. But I do it, and as long as my mother-in-law is alive, I will do it for the different holidays. Because it's, in my house, it's a chance for my mother-in-law to be center stage. And she stands there, and she's very elderly now and very frail. But she thinks about her mother when she's putting, she likes to take the head of the fish and put the, to have the eyes there. She puts carrots in the eyes, and she always says, every time she does it, she stuffs that head, and she says, my mother always ate the head of the fish. And her parents have perished in Belzec's concentration camp. And this is her moment to think about them, and again, she's making it for her children and grandchildren. So it's sort of a continuity of life.
My guest is Joan Nathan, host of the new PBS series Jewish Cooking in America and author of the companion book. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is Joan Nathan, host of the new PBS series Jewish Cooking in America and author of the companion book. Part of the book explores how keeping a kosher kitchen affected Jewish cooking. For example, part of keeping kosher means never mixing meat and milk in the same meal, and that makes some dishes and some preparation styles off limits. There's something very funny in your book, Jewish Cooking in America. You write about how Crisco was the first vegetable shortening that in Jewish cooking could be considered parv, which is it's neutral. It's neither considered, you know, milk or meat. So you could use anything. You could cook anything in Crisco. And so Crisco developed an advertising campaign geared toward Jewish cooks. And it said that this was the product that the Hebrew race had been waiting for 4,000 years.
I love that. That's one of my favorite anecdotes from the book. But what's also interesting is that Crisco, as a company, when they put out a Yiddish-English cookbook for the Jewish population, they also put out a Japanese-English cookbook for the Japanese population of Hawaii. And my guess is, and this was in the teens or early 20s, was that they realized that they would use Crisco for tempura. So they were reaching out.
Now, before things like Crisco, Jewish cooks use schmaltz, which is chicken fat.
Right. They also use beef fat.
But they probably had more chicken around than beef. How would you cook with schmaltz?
Well, you would use it in a way the way you would use Crisco. First, what you would do is you would try to render the fat. And if you're using it for a dessert, you wouldn't put onions in it. You would just cook it down, cook the fat down, and then once it's cooled, it looks a little bit like Crisco. I mean, it's a little bit different color.
White and pasty.
Right, white and pasty. And then what you would do is you would use it the way you would use butter, let's say, in a recipe. It's the same with beef. But then if you want it to be very flavorful, let's say for chopped liver, you might saute it when you're cooking it down with onions. And then there's a lot more flavor to it. But you wouldn't want that for dessert, of course.
Is your interest in Jewish food more about taste or about tradition?
I think mine is, I would say it's more about tradition. It's really, I'm interested in the story behind the food. I like the food. But what really is my primary concern is carrying on that tradition. I mean, if I thought they were bad tasting foods, I wouldn't include them in my books. But I really like the link between a person, his recipe, and his past. That's what really drives me.
Do you find that there are new foods or new variations on old foods being added to the repertoire?
Well, there are definitely new variations on old foods. I mean, look at what's happening with bagels. You know, that's a great example.
The chocolate chip bagel.
Exactly.
The apple honey bagel.
Or knishes. I mean, do you think that your grandmother ever had a broccoli knish? Certainly Madison Avenue has changed the way that Jewish people ate in America.
How?
Well, every time that a new product came on the market, let's say canned pineapples. Somebody might have wanted to sell them to the Jewish public. And so that what they smartly did was they'd find recipes to include with dull pineapple, crushed pineapple, make a really good kugel with pineapple, and send it packaged. There used to be all these little recipes that were sent out. There was a wonderful man named Joseph Jacobs he knew that the immigrant Eastern European women desperately wanted to be American. But they didn't read English, just like Italian-American women. I'm sure this was not just limited to a Jewish population. And what he did was he went to people like Joseph Kraft and said to them, I will translate your recipes into Yiddish. Will you please give me some recipes? I'll translate them and we'll put them in the Yiddish press. Then he'd have advertisers. These women could be more American. So you'd see ads for, let's say, Crisco for American fried chicken, with people like Molly Goldberg showing people how to make them in the Yiddish press. And so these women wanted to be American, and they talk about, in Yiddish, limon pie or banana pie, you know, and with a Yiddish accent. And they were written in transliteration in Yiddish, but American pie. There was no pie in Eastern Europe. And they wanted to make a double-crusted American pie, and that's what they learned to do. From all these, and so that was early on. And then, of course, when people started reading English, They would send them to different Jewish newspapers in English, like canned pineapple, cream cheese, and give them different versions of each recipe so that people could try something new. Cranberry stuffed cabbage. We have that in one of our shows.
Hmm. The Jewish High Holy Days are coming up.
Right.
And Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement, where people who observe fast from sundown to sundown.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how your family broke the fast when you were growing up.
When I was growing up, we always came to our house, and my mother still does it, and she does it alone now. She's 85. She might have one or two people, but she doesn't like to break it with a big party, which is becoming very much an American tradition. And we always broke it with herring and sour cream, my mother's recipe. It's one of my cookbooks. And a little bit of wine. And just bagels, cream cheese, that kind of thing. But a light meal.
But a lot of it, right?
A lot of it. A lot of a light meal, right, exactly.
And what would you eat before breaking the before fasting? Would you have a huge meal the
night before? No, absolutely not. It would be something like roast chicken. I always have something like the chicken fricassee. You don't want anything that's too salty because you don't want to be thirsty throughout the fast. And we have it very, very early, in, you know, like at about 5:30, because we have to be at our synagogue by 6:30. So I make a very quick meal, and it's only our family. I never have people before. It's just too hurried, and, you know, the important thing is really not the meal. It's going to synagogue. It's the one day a year that you really don't, at least I don't think about food. I never do break the fast. I used to when I felt that I was thinking about who was coming over and what I had to do during the fast of Yom Kippur, and I've just decided that's the one day I'm not ever cooking. So I'm grateful every year when friends invite us over.
Well, I wish you an early Happy New Year.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It was my pleasure.
Joan Nathan is the host of the new PBS series Jewish Cooking in America and author of the companion book. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross, and we'll close with the music of Mickey Katz.
Don't let the schmaltz get in your eyes, don't let the locks get in your socks. It shears gauze with blintzes and eggs with salami. Don't let the schmaltz get in your eyes. Oh, you look like a dream geschmiert with sour cream, and you know tzatzkele, you're the one for me. Too many bagels.
Too many bagels.
Too many shell shells.
Too many shell shells.
Just like a blimp, you're full of gas.
Just like a blimp full of gas.
If I'm gone too long and your pipik starts to jump, when the stars come out, I'll bring a stomach bomb. Don't let the schmaltz get in your eyes, don't let the soup get in your snoot.
Soup in the snoot?
It's rocking the boat, you're beginning to blow. You're riding on the derma road, you ask me for a kuss, with kegel on your puss, you know tzatzkele on me, that don't look good. Too many crepes, and too many grapes, lah. Oops, pardon me, you fresh just like there's no tomorrow. But lay off the ham, cause with ham you lose Sam. And I like my kachkis strictly cause your style. Don't let the schmaltz get in your eyes, don't let the milts get on your kilts.
Don't let the milts on your kilts.
My little honey bun. You'll soon weigh a ton. Don't let the schmaltz get in your eyes. Oh, stop the horn, my love, and someday you'll take off, and I'll say, bon voyage, my darling, crack the cup.
Je
break the cup. Je break the cup. Don't let the schmaltz get in your eyes.